Hello, in recent audio snippets, we have been talking about Black America and slavery. And in the previous audio snippet, we were talking about the start of the Civil War and Lincoln's behavior at the beginning of the war and as it developed. And today we're going to continue doing that. We saw before how Lincoln really did not want to end slavery and was obsessed and concerned about preserving the Union. That was his goal in life. And if he had been able to cut the Civil War short and preserve slavery, he would have done it. So he was a man who did not understand his position, his time in history, that he was a man placed at the right place and the right time to do the right thing. And everything was set up in such a dramatic way that many things happened even despite Lincoln, not because of him. And that's important. He was always reacting, holding on to an ideology of the past, you could say, instead of forging a new reality. And that is kind of at the heart of what's wrong with conservatism. So, in a sense, Lincoln is the ultimate conservative. He wanted to conserve or preserve the Union. He wanted to go back to the past, and he kept reacting to everything that was trying to, in a sense, get us away from that past. And he was always on the defensive, you could say, you know, like a defensive back in American football. A defensive back doesn't worry about gaining yardage. He's always going back and trying to guard the other team's receivers to prevent them gaining yardage. So it's always destructive work. You're not producing, you're just trying to destroy someone else's activity, in a sense. And a defensive back in football has to be able to react to the wide receiver's movements. He has to react to where the ball is thrown. So it's always reacting, reacting, reacting. And that's okay if you're playing in a defensive position in any sport. But to permanently be on the defensive is a recipe for disaster. A person who is always reacting and never causing things to happen is always doomed to be the victim of circumstances. And that's what conservatism is. It teaches you to play defense all the time instead of taking charge and forging a reality. But sometimes to take that attitude, you have to understand what the new reality is supposed to be, and you have to understand what's wrong with the current reality. But if you keep living in the past and you keep thinking that everything is kind of okay and we just have to go along, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If you keep thinking like that, you're bound to just react to anything that that's, quote, breaks that imperfect world that you are treating as if it was perfect. And that was what Lincoln and conservatives are all about, reactionaries who want to, who have in their minds glorified or raised to the level of perfection something that was anything but perfect. So despite all the evidence, despite the Union literally collapsing before his eyes, he refused to see what was wrong with the system he was trying to defend. And before continuing, it's also worth mentioning this, and I believe we may have mentioned this before, but I do believe it's worth mentioning yet again in more detail, and that is that there's a certain irony in Lincoln fighting so hard to preserve the Union. He saw the Civil War as the mechanism to preserve America, the Union that was known as America. And if you think about it, there was something fundamentally wrong with that thought on its own, because it assumes there's something you are preserving. And you cannot preserve something that is no longer there. In other words, if we can put it in a different way, if a couple have divorced and the divorce has been finalized legally, the husband may, or the one of the spouses may want to return to the marriage, but in that situation, that spouse is not preserving the marriage. He is trying to marry again, if you see what I'm saying. There is no marriage to preserve because the marriage has been destroyed. There is nothing to preserve. You can preserve the marriage before the divorce, not afterwards. And the question would be, was there a divorce in the Civil War? Or was it just two married people, in a sense, fighting against each other very fiercely? And the answer is that there had already been a divorce. And why can we say that? And I think this is important to point out, because it goes to the root of the problem, a root that Lincoln and others were unwilling to recognize. And it has to do with the legitimacy of the Union and the legitimacy under the U.S. Constitution. And as we've shared before, conservatives always emphasize this, especially the more, you could say, academic or more conceptually strict conservatives, they tend to emphasize the fact that the U.S. Constitution was, in a sense, given credibility by the states. And you may say, what does that mean, or what's so relevant about that? But just think about it. Conservatives believe, and I do believe they are right in when they say this, that the way the American Union was set up under the Constitution, it was the states who said the Constitution has credibility, therefore we are letting it exist. In other words, conservatives think of the U.S. Constitution as something that the sovereign states, colonies, you know, and who then became quote states, the sovereign colonies entered into. They entered into this contract or agreement, and therefore gave the contract validity. So the contract owes its life to the states. And remember that term, sovereign states. We, many audio clips ago, talked about how the 11th Amendment came to be, the First Amendment after the Bill of Rights. And we spoke of how it was there to protect the sovereignty of states, that a state's sovereignty was more important than the rights of the individual. And we went through the case, the court case that led to Congress passing the 11th Amendment. There was, as you may recall, a man in one state who was owed money by another state in the South, by the way. And so he sued that state who owed him money that he had lent to that colony during the Revolutionary War, and never got paid back. He had passed away, but his family sued to recover that money, and they won the case. And then eventually Congress passed the 11th Amendment and overturned the decision, because the state that was being sued said, "How dare you sue us? We as a sovereign state are the ones who decide whether that that trial has any legal legitimacy. As a sovereign state, if we don't acknowledge the trial is not legal." It's like someone saying, like a thief who stole money from someone else, having the power, and then being sued for having stolen that money, you could say, or done some wheeling and dealing to take that money illegally from the other person. It's as if that person who took the money or stole who swindled the other guy out of his money had the power to say, if I don't acknowledge the lawsuit that is being placed against me, the lawsuit is not legal. Imagine how powerful that would be for a criminal to be able to decide, oh yeah, unless I acknowledge the lawsuit, the lawsuit does not have any legal standing. Then obviously you're only going to acknowledge a lawsuit if it suits you. So that's how sovereign a state was. And an individual, an American individual, had no authority to sue a sovereign state, a state that he was not a part, that he did not belong to. That's how radical the concept of the sovereign state is. And we went through all the details before when we talked about the 11th Amendment. And that is at the heart of the Constitution, and conservatives always emphasize that. So they always say the states gave the Constitution credibility when they entered into that contract of, you know, of ratifying the Constitution and joining into the Union. In other words, the Constitution owes its life to the states. And if the states had chosen not to give life to the Constitution, then the Constitution would have never come into being. It's almost like, when abortionists say that the life of the fetus is only to be protected if the mother acknowledges the validity of that life. When the mother acknowledges the validity of that life, then suddenly that fetus becomes a baby. Then that fetus becomes something that is worth protecting from a moral and a legal standpoint. But if the mother says, "I don't want this thing," then that fetus goes from being a baby to just being an inconvenience, like an appendix that you have to take out because it's causing you problems in your personal life, not health problems, but problems in your personal life. So it's as if the mother acts like this Caesar, this Roman emperor, who either gives a thumbs up or thumbs down to indicate whether he wants the person to live or die, and it's up to them. That's the same thing with the Constitution and the states. From the conservative perspective and from the historical perspective, that is how the Constitution came to be. So the states, the colonies, could have aborted the Constitution, just like a woman can abort a fetus, according to the abortionist, because the woman says, "I don't recognize the validity of this life. Hence, I can terminate it at my convenience, at my will." And that kind of shows that there's like a metaphysical equivalence between abortion and federalism. this is federalism, you know, where you acknowledge the existence of these sovereign states that are loosely coupled together in a federated manner. Federalism. There is a metaphysical equivalence between federalism and abortion, and the abortion issue. And those of you who might be into mathematics may know about topology and how topology is a branch of mathematics where you compare the equivalence of shapes that may look very different on the outside. So you take these two shapes and you say these are topologically equivalent because you can take this shape and somehow massage it into looking like the other shape. And there are certain shapes that you cannot massage into looking like other shapes. For example, you cannot massage a donut shape into a sphere because the moment you, like, if you try to squeeze the donut together into a ball, then it loses it completely loses its nature. But you can massage a donut into looking like a tire or things like that. In a sense, you could say that abortion and federalism are topologically equivalent. And that's why we've been talking about abortion recently, especially because abortion has been on the news at the time of this recording, because Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion nationally, has been overturned, and now it's going back to the states. And one state is deciding to defend the life of the fetus, and other states are ramping up the effort to destroy fetuses even more. And conservatives are happy about that. That's the way it should be. And as we said before, that, you know, a fetus in California has no consolation and say, oh, well, yes, I guess that's the way it is. I was conceived into the state of California, so my life really does not matter, and that's okay. I wish I'd been conceived in Texas or some other state, Idaho, or some other place where abortion is being restricted. So when we start to kind of leave it up to the states to define what right is valid and what right isn't, fundamental right. We're not talking about some ephemeral thing like some states saying a bar should all close by 1 a.m. as opposed to bars can stay open all night. You know, that restricts people's ability to go drink on weekends and so forth. You might question that. Is that fundamentally correct to impose such a restriction or not? But it's also about a subject that is so ambiguous that you know, you could maybe justify that in some states bars have to be closed by 1 a.m. because maybe they have a larger vampire population than other states, and it's dangerous for people to be outside after 1 a.m. Because they might be attacked by a vampire and killed, as opposed to another state. So there might be circumstantial reasons for one state to do it and not the others. And even then, I personally believe that there should be a justification, a clear justification, that if a law is passed in a state or a city that is, in a sense, different from what's in other states or cities, that state or city must have a justification for it, an absolute non-relative justification that this should say, okay, we have certain circumstances in this state that prompt this to be a reality, and if those same circumstances were applicable in any other state, then that other state should really have the same law we have. And that should be challengeable. That should be legally challengeable by other states, where we are trying to have the same code of law throughout the whole land. If someone kills someone else in a certain way, on one side of the Texas Louisiana border, and then someone else commits exactly the same crime on the other side of that border, both crimes should have the same penalty. Why should one be penalized with 25 years and the other one be penalized with 10 years if it's the exact same crime? There has to be something that justifies the differences. But so in this case, in the abortion issue, we're not talking about what time bars can close, something that really kind of maybe affects your rights in a very indirect way. It's not like life or death, literally, like abortion. This is a very fundamental thing. And to leave it up to the states, and for conservatives to be happy about leaving a fundamental right up to the states, and to see that as the normal and acceptable way of things, it just shows the stupidity of conservatives. And that same mindset is what allowed states to say, well, we want to have slaves. We want to suppress the rights and the liberties of certain individuals who have no power, political power, to change the system. And it's our prerogative. We want to do it. You go to hell, or you get off my state if you want to change our way of thinking. It's none of your business. You go back to your state and leave us alone. That is the protection that federalism gave to slavery. Now that's the same protection as that federalism is giving to abortion. And in both cases, you have someone who has no power to change things. The slave could not say, oh, if you don't change slavery, I'm going to go to the polls in the next election and vote for the other party that is against slavery. They couldn't do that because they were not legally recognized or capable of voting in the same way. A fetus in California cannot say, if you don't stop this abortion stuff, I'm going to go vote against you in the next elections, because the fetus is going to be dead by then. And we would have to wait 18 years or however long it is for that fetus to finally have the right to vote. So we're talking about people who can't defend themselves. We're democratizing truth, which is ironically what conservatives so disdainfully hate about non-conservatives. They always say, you want everything by democracy. We're not a democracy. We are a republic. And they say that with so much pride. We're not ruled by the majority, by the mob. Oddly enough, at the state level, then it is majority rule. If the majority of the state wants abortion, then we have abortion. If the majority of the state doesn't want abortion, then we don't want abortion. And it's up to each group of people, in each state, to decide. Same thing with slavery. If the people of California did not want slavery, then slavery was illegal in California. I mean, that's exactly how California was entered into the Union. They allowed California to decide, do you want slavery or do you not want slavery? California said, we don't want slavery. So it entered the Union in 1850 as a free state. So fundamental rights are being decided by democratic vote, involving people who have no power to affect that vote. So then you have the tyranny of the majority at the state level. But that's okay to conservatives, as long as it doesn't happen at the federal level. And again, that is just that's a person who is almost schizophrenic, that can have within him two dichotomous ideas, two things that are totally contradictory, just living side by side in apparent harmony. Just like liberals. Liberals are like that too. They can believe in two very contradictory things and pretend like there's nothing wrong with what they're doing or thinking. And that's how conservatives behave when it comes to the issue of federalism. But going back to Lincoln and the Union, Lincoln was right and conservatives are right. The U.S. Constitution was written, the spirit behind it was we are just trying to force an agreement, a contract that sovereign states can enter into. And if the Constitution had not been ratified by the states, then just like a mother with a fetus that doesn't want the fetus anymore, the mother could have aborted the fetus. In this case, the states could have aborted the Constitution, and there would have never been a Constitution. So when the states entered the Constitution, they did not surrender their sovereignty. Clearly, they did not surrender their sovereignty to enter into the Union. And it's not like someone who leaves behind the past to enter into something new, losing its privileges in order to enter into this new union with other states. Each state went in with their own little crown saying, you know, who you're not the boss of me, and I'm just coming here to this party and joining it and becoming part of this new nation. But don't you dare mess with me because I'm sovereign, man. I'm sovereign. So no one surrendered their crown to enter into this melting pot to form a true nation, a true union. And because of that, then yes, if according to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, you have people who say, I don't want to live under tyranny anymore, and I choose to step away from that tyranny and enter into a different form of a different contract, different form of government, I have the right to do so. But this is at the state level, not at the individual level, at the human level. It's at the state level, or colony level in this case. If that's the case, why were the southern states obligated to stay with inside the Union? If the Union was really this, for example, like Britain in the EU, Britain or any other country that entered the EU was not surrendering their sovereignty. They still were a nation state, and they were just entering into this global agreement with other other nations, other European nations. But because they never fully surrendered their national sovereignty as a state, they had the authority to withdraw from it. And the EU could bitch and moan about it, but eventually they did have the right, and they did exit the European Union eventually. So the same thing applies to the Constitution and the federal system and the states. If the South really believed that it was having its rights, quote, violated by this evil, ever-increasingly tyrannical federal government, the southern states had the right, legally, under that scheme, to say, the hell with all y'all, we are going on our own, just like we separated from Britain in 1776, we are separating from you, because just like Britain in 1776, you're becoming a tyrant to us, because we want to continue with this slavery thing. It's good business, and we don't want to change it. We don't care what God thinks. We don't care what morality thing says. We don't care what the rest of the world says. We don't care what Britain has been doing, ending slavery all over the place. We don't care about that. We want to be our own people, owning other people. So they had the right to leave they really did. From a legal standpoint, the moment they started seceding, the union was over. There were the divorce had happened because they had the authority to end that contract. They had the authority to say, we gave life to this thing. If we had not accepted this document, we would not be, there would be no constitution. So now we're withdrawing our support. You do your thing, we're going to do ours. Just like federalism is always espoused, you do your thing, we'll do ours. And ours is slavery, yours is not. So the hell with you, leave us alone, we're going to do our own thing. So Lincoln had nothing, no union to preserve. The union ended. When he was inaugurated, as we said before, 7 states had already seceded because they saw Lincoln as this abolitionist who was coming to end their slavery when he really wasn't. As we said before, it's as if Lincoln was given this cloak, even against his will. And that cloak was from the prayers of all the people who had been praying fervently for America to finally end its stupidity of slavery. So he had this persona over him against his will, and that's how the South perceived him, because he was cloaked by the prayers and all the energy, or whatever you want to call it, of the country, of the people who had fervently been praying for the end of slavery. And that's what the South kept seeing, this monster that really was not there. And I say monster from their perspective. From the perspective of truth, he would have been the hero, this giant hero, liberator. But he wasn't a giant hero or liberator, but the time had come. So even against his own will, he became to the South what he was supposed to be, even though he wasn't it, if you follow my thinking. So there was no union to preserve. Then if he had understood that, if Lincoln had instead of being a stupid conservative, like the stupid conservatives of today, if he had understood, okay, at this moment, the South has seceded. I'm not going to recognize their separation, but I know there's something wrong with their separation. There's something fundamentally wrong, and I'm going to fight to make sure that the country is not divided this way. If he had kind of thought it out, said, okay, I know this is true. We have to force these sons of bitches back into the American nation, whether they like it or not, and we have to end the slavery, and that we cannot leave it like that. We are responsible for those people being enslaved, and we're not just going to say, okay, you do your thing, we'll do ours, and we're going to coexist as these two sovereign nations, one with slavery and the other one without slavery. And that wouldn't have worked out too well either, because there was still slavery in the Union. Maryland had slavery. Delaware, I think, had slavery. And I forget what other states had slavery within the Union. So then what? We would have had another division inside the Union. Then we would have had, 3 different countries, and then maybe the Maryland and Delaware or whatever other state would have then joined the Confederacy, and then would have been truly a free America versus a slave America. We don't know. But the thing is that he knew that state of things was wrong, but he didn't stop and think, okay, if this is wrong, then but the current system we have kind of legalizes or gives legitimacy to the states seceding, because it glorifies the sovereignty of the state, that if he had put those two and two together, he would have had to conclude, well, either I embrace this as, okay, this is just the way it is. I don't have the power as part of the federal government to force the states back into the Union. If doing that was clearly wrong, then that meant that the whole system that we have had up until then was wrong, that federalism was fundamentally flawed. If he had come to that realization and said, okay, I can't defend federalism anymore, because it, clearly, if federalism is real and valid, then I have to let the southern states go, and we have to become two separate nations. But he never understood that. But if he had, then he would have said, okay, then federalism is wrong. Then he would have become the preacher of to the American people of what was wrong with our system. And he could have been a catalyst for this transformation of the entire American history and experience. But he wasn't, because he was a conservative. He was just trying to preserve the past. He was just reacting to things that were trying to destroy this past that was inherently flawed. And as things happened, instead of reacting, say, okay, this means there's something wrong with the system, they just tried to solve the symptom without dealing with the root. And that's what conservatives are constantly doing. And now we have this situation where abortion is legal in one state, not legal in another, and that's happiness for the conservative. Because, if you don't like that, you can walk with your feet. Well, tell that to the fetus. Are you going to tell, fetus, if you don't like being aborted in California, just walk with your feet and go live in another state. Yeah, right. Just like a slave in the South. If you don't like slavery, then walk with your feet and go to another state. And they would try to do that, but sometimes they'd get caught, sometimes they wouldn't. The thing is that if he had understood that, then he would have gone on the offensive. And that was a problem during the beginning of the Civil War, that he was on the defensive trying to preserve the Union, and the army fought that way. It was in defensive mode, reacting to the rebellion of the South and trying to get them back into the Union, to go back to the way we were. And if he had understood this federalism contradiction, then he either would have said, okay, I'm going to stick with federalism, and if I do so, then I have to let the South go. Or he could have done what he did, you know, fight the South to preserve the Union, or to kind of bring them into the Union again, because there was nothing to preserve, as we said. So he would have fought to bring the Union together, the states back into the Union, but then he would have become the catalyst for ending federalism and saying, okay, we're going to be fighting these sons of bitches in the South, and we're going to do this. Even if we don't, this is not to preserve the Union, it's not to bring America back together, it's to do justice, because we allowed the injustice of slavery to continue beyond 1776. As we said before, slavery had a legitimate reason for being. It happened for a reason that goes beyond the scope of American history, because of evil going on in Africa. And Black people had to be punished, and they had to go through this historical experience of being shackled and chained and forced to do what they were unwilling to do. They were unwilling to fulfill their calling, their visionary calling, and they were misusing it, cannibalizing each other, and they had to be punished that way and brought and dragged to a different environment to start anew and be given opportunities so that future generations could enjoy opportunities away from the shackles of what was going on in Africa, because Africa is shackled. It's spiritually shackled, and it has nothing to do with the white man. It's Africans shackling each other constantly, and that literally was what happened with slavery during the slave trade, as we went into great detail before in other audio snippets. This is just historical reality. It was African kings who would go and invade rival kingdoms to go and capture slaves to sell them to the white man for the slave trade. And they got angry at Britain when Britain decided to end slavery. They said, this is not good for business. They literally said that, the Black African kings. So there was a lot of evil that still goes on to this day. All the dictators and all the oppression and all the carnage, all the vicious stuff that has gone on in Africa. all these black people that were brought to the Americas were in a way kind of mercifully taken away from that and forced to look at themselves and to have and were given the opportunity to be in a new environment, to start anew. And so slavery had a purpose up until 1732, and we had to start phasing it out until 1776, and then maybe one final phase until 1788, when we had the Constitution ratified, and the American nation officially, you could say, was born then. It was conceived in 1776, but it was actually given, it became a reality, a birthed nation with an actual system of government, and then a president and all that in 1788, and then 1789 when Washington became the first president. So slavery had to end, and we had the moral responsibility of punishing the South, just like blacks needed to be punished for what they were doing in Africa. Now we had to punish the South for what they were doing to black people, and America would have been destroyed as a nation if we had just let the South secede and allowed slavery to continue in the South. I can assure you the American experiment would have ended shortly after that. The American nation would have died at that very moment, and that would have been just a matter of time, just like it's about to happen right now, as we said, within 14 months, more or less. If something drastic does not happen in America, then the American nation will die. Its destiny will be gone. And this nation will slowly or quickly deteriorate into third world status, or, you know, very low level rich nation status. But I think even that will be taken away. The country will be like a big Venezuela. But the thing is that if Lincoln had said, okay, this federalism thing clearly does not work. If I abide by it and am consistent with myself, then the union is over. So I have to say no to federalism. And so what reason is there to get the South back into the union? Well, there is one reason. First of all, we have to punish those sons of bitches and force them to end slavery, because it's our fault that we were able to talk with it. We tolerated it when they were with us. So that atrocity is on our heads, that the blood of the slaves is on us. And if we don't end slavery in the South, even if it's against their will, it will be on us. And will be made responsible, the American nation will suffer. So he would have then been able, Lincoln, if he'd understood all of this, been able to rally the nation against slavery and then become the speaker, the voice, to end our current system and start something new. Like, we have to rewrite the Constitution, because clearly the Constitution does not protect the right to life, doesn't protect the right to property. It doesn't protect the rights of individuals as it should, because it has given the states more power than the individual. He would have been doing what we're doing in these audio snippets. The things we're saying in these audio snippets would have been said by Lincoln, maybe not in the detail or in the way that we're trying to say it, but he would have started back in the 1860s to say these same things, and we would have had time to change all of the whole course of American history from then until now, and it would be a completely different nation. But he didn't do it, because he refused to get away from his conservatism. He wanted to conserve the current state of things. And all he saw in the Civil War was a way to get the South back into the Union, so that we could again be what we were before. This federal mess, and that's why he was constantly on the defensive. And he then, But something changed at some point as the war dragged on, and we'll go into maybe some on some other snippet into some of the brief details about how the war was, how and why the war dragged on so much at the beginning. But as it drug on, it's as if Lincoln finally realized, okay, I have to do something because my reactionary approach is not working. That's when he finally did what anyone with common sense would have, with real common sense would have done from the beginning. He said, okay, I have to end slavery. This has to become the cause behind the Civil War. And even as he did that, he did it in a very cowardly way that we're going to talk about right now. In September of 1862, if I'm not mistaken, we're talking about 1 month after the letter that he wrote to Horace Greeley that we read in part the last time, where he said, "My paramount objective in this struggle is to save the Union, and it's not either to save or to destroy slavery." So 1 month after he wrote that letter and got really criticized for it, he announced that there was going to be an Emancipation Proclamation. So basically he issued a threat to the Southern states saying, if you don't end your rebellion, I am going to declare this, executive order, empowered by the Constitution, because we're in wartime, and as the Commander in Chief, I have the power to carry out these commands, these orders, and say in all the conquered, in all those states that are in rebellion against the Union, I'm going to declare the slaves as free, as an act of war. I am going to do that, and he said, I'm going to do it. So you better shape up and let's negotiate. I'm willing to talk, guys, but if you don't do this by the end of the year of 1862, then I'm going to make it official, and then the states that are in rebellion, their slaves will be legally, from our standpoint, declared free. And I have the power to do that because this is a wartime thing, and I am the commander-in-chief, and I can do that. So he kind of tried to look for a way to justify it within his limited and worthless system, the Constitution, because that was the only way to justify what he did, and to kind of like do it in a roundabout way. So he did this threat, and he thought, I think he sincerely thought, that the South was going to take the bait and say, okay, gotcha. He was giving them a choice and giving them 4 months. Just think about that, how disgusting that is. He was giving them 4 months to say, get back into the Union, and if you get back, we'll let you stay in slavery as long as you come back to the Union. But if you don't and you stay in rebellion before until past the end of this year, then your slaves are free in our view. We're going to declare them free. And he waited and waited, and he thought the South was going to react. And the South, he didn't understand the South. He didn't understand that the South was not watching him or listening to him. They were watching and listening to the monster that he was in their eyes because of the prayers of all the people who had been praying for the end of slavery, including black people, white abolitionists and black people who had been praying for the end of slavery. The South was seeing a monster, an abolitionist Lincoln. So no matter what he said or did, that's all they could see. Just like Democrats of nowadays, when they saw Trump, they didn't really see the real Trump. They saw what they perceived him to be because of the power, the authority that he was given by the righteous people of this nation. And he wasn't even close to that veil and cloak of authority that he had. But Democrats didn't understand that, and they hated him because they saw the cloak that was on him that was a reflection of the righteous people of this country more than a reflection of Trump himself. So the South said, the hell with you, we don't care. And actually, many of them felt emboldened to continue in their rebellion even more when they heard this threat. And eventually, 1863 came along, and then that made it official. Then Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Mind you, he issued the original threat, like, I'm going to do this if you don't comply and come back. He did that on September 22nd, 1862, exactly 1 month after the letter to Horace Greeley, which was on August 22nd, 1862. And 22 is like a number that seems to be always associated with civil war and division. Not sure exactly why. But the thing is that his proclamation took effect on January 1st of 1863. And the interesting thing about the Emancipation Proclamation that people don't understand is that he set all the slaves in the states and territories that are in rebellion are now officially free. But there was more or less an empty declaration because the North didn't have control over those territories. So slaves were free only in the territories where the North could not set them free. I hope you see what I'm saying. There's a certain irony in that. So he didn't free anybody up, or he freed very few people up when he said that. Now, this thing affected 10 states. He listed the states that would be affected by this proclamation. It was South Carolina, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, Virginia, Arkansas, and North Carolina. But interestingly, it explicitly did not include clearly it did not include Union slave states. In other words, states inside the Union that still had slavery. Maryland still had slaves. Delaware still had slaves. Missouri had slaves. And Kentucky had slaves. Those four states were slave states, but no slaves were liberated in the Emancipation Proclamation. They continued in slavery because he didn't feel empowered to end slavery. He never tried to end slavery in those states, because to him it's, oh, I can't push for the end of slavery in these states, because if I do that, then I'm telling the South that I really want to end slavery and they will never come back. So because Lincoln was a coward, so he can't allow those states to continue in their slavery instead of becoming the voice of, look at what slavery is doing. Look at the evil that's going on. And he could have begun to do what George Whitefield, stupid idiot, didn't do back in the 1700s. He could have become the moral voice of the nation and say to the nation, look, even Britain has ended slavery. And all these other nations see the evil of slavery. And we who are supposed to be the land of the free are still practicing it in such a vicious way. This has to end. And he could have begun that proclamation from the very beginning when the war broke out, to kind of call the conscience of the nation and invoke God. People believed in God in those days much more than they do now. He could have invoked and appealed to their beliefs in God, just like Whitefield would have done. He could have transformed the American psyche, but he chose his ministry over the well-being of black people. And we kind of spoke about that in some detail before. But Lincoln could have done that, and he didn't. So there were these slave states in the Union, but they were not touched by the Emancipation Proclamation. Also, he didn't include Tennessee in that proclamation. Tennessee had rebelled against the Union, but it had been kind of mostly taken back. So that was one of the, I think it might have been the first state that, first Confederate state that was, quote, reconquered in a way. So Tennessee was already kind of forced back into the Union, but not as a state. It was still, you know, like this territory that the Union had kind of reconquered, because that's what it really was. The Civil War was not a war to bring the states back, the southern states back into the Union. It was a war of conquest. It was one nation fighting against another. Because from the legal standpoint of what the Constitution, how the Constitution was built by the Founding Fathers, the Confederate States of America, the southern states, were a legitimate nation, separate nation. And what the United States was doing was conquering a foreign territory. The Confederate States of America was a real, legitimate, separate nation. And we were conquering this nation. Just like we conquered all that territory from Mexico, we were conquering all this territory from the slave-enforcing Southerners. I hope you see what I'm trying to say here. So Tennessee was actually a conquered territory controlled by the Union. There was a military government controlled by the Union running the state of Tennessee. It was not like Tennessee was back in the Union with representatives in Congress and the Senate and all that stuff. It was like a conquered territory run by the Union. And interestingly, he did not liberate. He could have done this massive liberation of people in Tennessee. He was controlling Tennessee, yet he didn't include Tennessee in. And you know why he did it? The son of a bitch coward, Lincoln, why he didn't do it? Because he didn't want Tennessee to, he's like, oh, okay, I already conquered this state. And I don't want people to get all riled up here. If I set the slaves free in Tennessee, then all hell's going to break loose. And the people in Tennessee, the white racists in Tennessee are going to rally. And we're going to lose Tennessee again. So he didn't have the courage to liberate the slaves in a state that he was controlling. The other thing is there were specific exemptions that were stated in the Emancipation Proclamation for areas under Union control. Aside from Tennessee, there were 48 counties in Virginia that would become the state of West Virginia. Certain parts of counties of Virginia did not like slavery, so they kind of sided with the Union, and those counties eventually became the state, the modern day state of West Virginia. And so even though they were separating to escape slavery, West Virginia was a territory that had been part of a state that had rebelled, so technically it would fall under the Emancipation Proclamation, but he said, no, I'm excluding those states too, that region too, of Virginia. So why? They are separating from Virginia because they hate slavery, yet Lincoln did not have the courage to say, well, then in West Virginia, there shall be no slavery. If there's any slave in West Virginia, he's going to be free. You know why? Because he didn't want to stir the white racists in West Virginia and rally them and then lose West Virginia as well. See the cowardice of this man? There were certain slaves that were freed immediately, a few, not too many, but there were a few. And so there were certain Union occupied areas in the Confederate States where the proclamation was immediately put into effect by local Union commanders. And these are the places where slaves were set free. Look at the glorious list. Winchester, Virginia. Before studying about this proclamation, I frankly never knew, ever heard of the city or town of Winchester, Virginia, ever in my life. And Winchester, Virginia, is this humongous city in Virginia that in 2020, in that census, was reported to have a population of 28,120. So I can only imagine what the population was back in 1863. So that huge town, all the slaves in that humongous town were set free. Another place where the Emancipation Proclamation took effect immediately and slaves were actually freed was in the humongous city of Corinth, Mississippi. I think I had heard of Corinth once in my life, once or twice in my life. I mean, the only city that I could, you know, recall off the top of my head from Mississippi is Tupelo, Mississippi, and that's only because of Elvis. I think that's where he was born, Elvis Presley. But other than that, I'd not be able to mention the name of any city or town in Mississippi. Maybe there is a Jackson, Mississippi, I'm not sure. But it would have taken, like, a long time for me to even remember or be aware that there was a Corinth, a city or town named Corinth in Mississippi. Well, this town of Corinth, Mississippi, had slaves set free as well by the Union immediately. And this massive town in Mississippi or city had a population of 14,622 in the 2020 census. So you can only imagine how many people there were back in 1863. Another humongous region where the slaves were set free was the city of Key West, Florida. And I have heard of that one. Everyone, I think, has heard of Key West, Florida. Key West, Florida is this like little, it's the southernmost city in the contiguous 48, in the lower 48 of the United States. It's as far south as you can go. It's like going all the way to the very end of Florida. And that, and even though it's well known because it's a party place and all that, or a vacation spot, it's not a big city. In the 2020 census, the population was recorded to be 26,444. So you can imagine how many people were living in Key West back in 1863. How many slaves were set free, you know, in Key West. And then there was another humongous city that I had never heard of called Port Royal, South Carolina, which in the 2010 census had 10,678 people officially. So you can only imagine how many people were living in 1863. In this little town that was under Union control, the slaves were set free as well. And then the other, only other place where slaves were set free immediately were the Sea Islands, S-E-A, the Sea Islands, which is like this large group of like 100 plus islands off the coast of the Carolinas and Georgia, and I think also down towards Florida. It's like if you go in a map, they're not that well known. And in fact, I didn't know about those islands until I was reading about the Emancipation Proclamation. But there are these 100 islands off the coast of the southeast of the United States. It's 100 islands lining the coast, the southeast coast of the U.S., and they're known as the Sea Islands. And in those Sea Islands, it's estimated around 5,000 slaves were set free. And it's kind of interesting because I'd be surprised that there were slaves at all in those islands, because why would someone grow stuff on the island instead of on the mainland, off these kind of like off the beaten path places, these islands off the coast of the southeast. But yes, there were slaves there and they were set free. So, and that's it. So the places where the Emancipation Proclamation boldly set slaves free when it was proclaimed was Corinth, Mississippi, Winchester, Virginia, Key West, Florida, Port Royal, South Carolina, and the Sea Islands. That's it. And then all the other slaves who were under Confederate control, they were officially free, but they were still in slavery. It did have an effect even beyond maybe what Lincoln may have wanted it to be, because after the Emancipation Proclamation, the Union Army began to see its mission as not just the restoring of the Union, but as the its mission was now the freeing up of slaves. Like, we enter into a state and we conquer it, we're going to set the slaves free. And they began to do that. So the Union Army went from this defensive reactionary stance to a more morally guided stance. And that's when the tide began to change. That's when the Civil War just took a different turn and the North went on the offensive. That's when the North stopped being a conservative, trying to conserve the past, and went on attack mode. And as we've said, conservatives are reactionaries, and that's why they're always losing out to the liberals in America, because the liberals are always on the offensive and conservatives are always reacting, playing defense. But in this case, the North went from being a conservative to being on attack mode, because he said, now I have a mission to set the black people free. And the Union Army began to fight a different way. Then they also were able to get black people to join them. And as they were, going, marching into states, the black slaves would run, try to escape from the plantations to join the Union Army, because they said, okay, now I have a haven. And they would join the army and start fighting with the Union Army. It just completely changed the dynamic of the war. And also internationally, other countries that were kind of ambivalent about what to do with the Confederate States, should we recognize it, should we not recognize it? The moment the Emancipation Proclamation happened and the Civil War went from being a war to save the Union to a war to end slavery, at that point, countries like the United Kingdom and others, and France, said, oh, we don't like you, South Confederate States. We don't recognize you because you are upholding slavery and we oppose slavery. Imagine that the UK and France, the UK, the tyrant, Britain, King George, the evil tyrant, nation of Britain, was condemning, the United States, the American states that were opposing freedom and upholding slavery. But the Emancipation Proclamation kind of gave them that final push that they needed to then oppose the South and say, we're not going to give you diplomatic recognition. And that's when the Confederate States began, that country called the Confederate States of America became more and more isolated internationally, receiving less help and less less support from the rest of the world. And it all changed when Lincoln finally began to do what he had to do, and he did it timidly. He did it as a veiled threat. And the South called his bluff, and Lincoln was forced to then go ahead and do what he didn't want to do, which was to end slavery. And as we are saying all of this, we'll just finish with one important thing about the army, that this attitude that changed in the Union Army as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation, and how the army just, its thinking, the soldiers and everybody changed their thinking. It's also gives us food for thought about what's wrong with the U.S. military. There's something within the U.S. military that needs to be changed. And it's something that I believe that in the new American Constitution needs to be addressed. And we were able to kind of get away from that evil thing that we'll go into more detail next time, hopefully. We were able to get away from that because of the Emancipation Proclamation, and that's why the army fought in a different way after that. And we were stuck in a certain mindset militarily because of this evil within the American military system that we have to get rid of. And that change in attitude that we had because of the Emancipation Proclamation should have kind of woken people up to realize there's something wrong with the military that we have to change. The military is built around certain principles that are destructive to it. And we have allowed that to continue, and conservatives have no problem with that that evil within the American military system. And I think that's why, fittingly enough, our military has become a joke. Now we have transvestites, generals being promoted, and I mean that literally. I don't remember the names, but there are certain generals that have been promoted to high positions of power within the military who are transvestites, men who want to be women. It's so ridiculous to see them in their military attire, dressed like women. It's so pathetic and so sad. And now we have the army promoting homosexual pride and all this other stuff. We have the decay of the military because there's something wrong within the military. We have all these military men and women who have accepted the rape by injection, you know, that that thing that has been promoted as a quote vaccine against the virus that's only killing people off. And so we have the decimation of the military because of that evil that's there. And we'll talk about that in the next audio snippet, hopefully, because I believe it's relevant to this whole thing. So we haven't really talked much about Black America in particular, but we're talking here about the how the fight to end slavery reflected what was wrong with the American system and what needed to be corrected. And this is independent of the value that Black America may or may not have now, because I don't think Black America wants to be rescued from its current state, and that's why it will never be, and it will never rise to what it was supposed to be. Black America gave it all up, and is not interested in being free, and therefore it shall not be free. But that does not take away from our responsibility to have given Black America the opportunity to be free much, much earlier. So I'm not fighting for Black America. To be frank, I don't give a damn about Black America, sadly, because I loved Black America. I truly loved Black America and saw the great potential, and I know it's gone. And there's no point in trying to save someone who doesn't want to be saved. It's very sad, but that doesn't take away from our responsibility in looking back and seeing what we did wrong to Black America, because we will never be healed as a nation unless we deal with that. And that's what these audio snippets are all about. I do believe that certain Black Americans will fulfill their calling, but not as a group, as a nation, as a people. They shall not see the promised land as a people, because they chose not to. So we will continue all of this in a future audio snippet, hopefully. Thank you for listening.